Hello, I'm Brian McKenna. I'm one of the editors at Computer Weekly, bidding you a very warm welcome indeed to the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
And those two other voices are...
I'm Caroline Donnelly. I'm a senior editor at Computer Weekly.
I'm not Claire McDonald, but I am Cliff Sarin, managing editor, open brackets, technology, close brackets, at Computer Weekly.
Yes, Cliff is functioning. Both of us as our special guest this week, but also substitute for Claire.
Yes.
And you have a very strange job title, Cliff. Do you want to explain it?
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? I asked for a promotion once.
Oh, I like
and they never ever give you promotions unless you have a changing job title. So I've been tech editor for 18 or 20 years, I think it says on LinkedIn. But so I'm technology managing editor, technology brackets, but I'm still the tech editor of Computer Weekly.
Basically, Cliff is very pan-technology, so he covers all sorts of stuff.
Pants? Pan?
Pants technology.
He pans technology, hates it.
Now, today's podcast, we're going to start off with Cliff. Cliff's going to talk about the... 30th anniversary of the World Wide Web, its birthday, which was quite recent. Caroline's going to share with us what she discovered at Cloud Expo /
Data Center World
at Excel. I'm going to talk a little bit about some research I was briefed on at Open Text's Enterprise World Europe event in Vienna through the week. And we're going to finish on the Furman Review. Cliff's going to lead off on that, and he's also going to start us off, so he's Alpha and Omega today. Cliff, the web, 30 years, Tim Berners-Lee invented it. Why? What was he thinking?
Well, Tim Berners-Lee, he created this document on March 12th, 1989. He submitted it. He was working at the CERN Particle Research Facility. Submitted this document to the sort of powers that be over there, and they basically said it was an interesting, but vague but interesting proposal.
Vague but interesting. Mm.
And the reason that he created this document for the World Wide Web was because they had trouble communicating with each other. Researchers would come and go, so they lost information, they lost knowledge just simply because of the way CERN worked. And so he created two parts of the web, a thing called the HTTP, or HTTPD, it's a server.
Yep.
Or in Unix terms, a daemon, that's why it's called HTTPD. And the HTTP server, which we know as an HTML server, and that's what we all use to browse the web these days. So that's how it all started. But if you look back, I mean, when I was at university, and this is a long time ago, we didn't have the web. I mean, 89, 88, didn't have the web. So how did you sort of, you know, you had to go to libraries, but we had things like email, and, you know, we had JanetNet, didn't we? JanetNet was the Joint Academic Network.
Yes, remember that? Yes.
Yeah, you would.
And I sent my first email in 1992.
Yes, and I think, well, what actually happened was in around 87, Vint Cerf, and he's one of the guys behind TCPIP, convinced the people that owned the internet, which was academia basically, that the internet should be opened up. And by opening up the internet, it allowed services like, you might remember, CompuServe in the US. I was a Kix user in the UK, CompuLink Information
I've still got a CompuServe fleece.
Have you?
Mm.
Well, those things were what we'd call walled gardens. So I could, if you were on CompuServe and I was on CompuServe, I could email you. But I couldn't email Caroline if she was on a different service like AOL or Kix or something. You'd be outside. It's a bit like if you think about Facebook. Mm. You know, Facebook Messenger is a walled garden.
Yeah,
it is.
So the internet was opened up, and thanks to that, we could all share email. And then a few years later, this is actually in 89, Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web. But it was owned by CERN, and effectively proprietary. No one knew what it was. I went to the 20th anniversary in 2009, And he had this box, this computer called a Next Computer, created by Steve Jobs. Black, you know, beautiful black workstation, Unix workstation, ran an operating system called NextStep. And he would carry it around to different research institutes and academic institutes and show them, this is the World Wide Web. Look at the World Wide Web. And then he'd go somewhere else and say, this is the World Wide Web. In 2003, Sony decided that the web was so important that it would give it away, made it public domain. And soon after, Marc Andreessen created the world's first web browser.
Netscape?
Mosaic. Mosaic was the world's first web browser. And after that, that's where we are. You know, I created my first website a few years later.
What was it? Can you remember?
It was, I used to work for a magazine called LotXe, and it was a software developers magazine, so it was a very good alignment. But at the same time, you know, The Guardian were doing stuff, and everyone was... start thinking, well, this is the next way of doing publishing, this is the next way of distributing information.
And in Computer Weekly, we began to talk about websites and company websites around about 95, 96.
Yeah, we were talking about things like, there was this little startup called Google, remember them?
They wouldn't go anywhere. 1998.
They wouldn't go anywhere. And then there was Amazon, and who would have thought Amazon? I mean, Amazon, what are you doing? You're just selling books. Okay, Waterstones was the first casualty, right? You know, that's all they were doing. Then they're selling music. Oh, and what happens to Tower Records? Remember Tower Records on Piccadilly Circus? Tower Records,
our
no
price.
More. Our price, no more record stores.
Yeah, and of course, Google replaced all those search engines that we
Alta
used
Vista,
to use.
Alta Vista, I used to use Yahoo.
InfoSeek, Lycos, yeah. Bring them back.
Ask Jeeves. They're still around. Though,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, they are still around. Northern Light was one of my favourites.
Yeah.
That involved actual librarians classifying things. But anyway, so Tim Berners-Lee has also written a letter to the world about
the
web.
World Wide Web Forum, and Tim Berners-Lee is one of the on the board of that group.
Yeah.
They want to look at a different way that the web can evolve. I mean, imagine it's gone from nothing and closed to where we are today, where anyone can publish anything. Mm. And some of the things are inappropriate, and some of the things are malicious. You know, publishing, you can publish a virus. Mm. There are markets for all sorts of stuff on the web, and you know, it's unfortunate that that has happened. And at the same time, you have really large companies almost taking control of the web. You know, when we started this conversation, we were talking about how you can send email outside of the email subscribers in service that you use.
Uh-huh.
You know, well, isn't it the same with the way Twitter works and the way Facebook works? It might be on the internet, but really, if you're not on there and or you don't get access to it, it's not, you know, same with Netflix. If you don't have access to that, you're effectively closed off from all of that content.
So what's he advocating then against this world of the new walled gardens? What's Tim Berners-Lee saying?
He's saying that there's the web was designed to be open and to share information. That's a really good thing. However, we need to come up with a different model for making money on the web. I mean, a different commercial model. That's one of his proposals. And we have to think about it. There's no answer. But if you make money out of, you know, simply by saying there's adverts on there, and the more adverts that click on a something, the more, you know, likely you're going to get money for it. And that is a model that has made some of the biggest web players mass, you know, they've become hugely successful. They, you know, the majority of the world's population seem to use, you know, this stuff. It's not perhaps the right approach, and is there a better way? So I think Tim and the World Wide Web Forum are looking at that and asking us to contribute ideas.
It's almost a bit paradise lost and now possibly paradise regained.
Well, they're trying to, but I think it's going to be very difficult now that it's out there. Mm. How you can, well, okay, you know, like, you know, Facebook and, you know, we've talked about these companies, Facebook, you know, Google, they haven't been around for that long. But look at the dominance that they have over everyone. I mean, look at the high street stores. I mean, we were talking just now about our price. Pretty much every high street store has posted not particularly brilliant results in the last quarter. And it's all down to the web and not understanding where the web is going and how to react to the likes of Amazon. Last year, Amazon bought Whole Foods for $13 billion. I mean, it's pennies for Amazon. But for our high street, for the likes of Marks and Spencer's, 13 billion is more than they would ever spend on any technology. They recently tied up with Ocado, and that was a £700 million sort of joint venture type thing. They've acquired half of Ocado,
which we discussed on this podcast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. Mm. So it just makes you think, well, you know, that these guys have got so much dominance.
So from the world of the web to the hell of Excel.
Oh God, it is. It actually is. So I was there for Cloud Expo Europe, which I don't know for definite, but I think it's just basically shorthand now I'm going to use it as shorthand for the fact that there's like 8 different shows there nowadays. So there's like Data Center World, so Cloud Expo and Data Center World are the ones I was most concerned with, but there's separate shows for blockchain, IoT, DevOps, everything really. So it's very much, you know, all about digital transformation. My priorities when I was there was basically trying to catch up with various people from the data center beat that I cover at Computer Weekly, and customer sessions as well. Like I say, there was only one of me there, so it's trying to prioritize what I was going to go along to. And there was quite a few things that sort of stood out for me.
Yeah.
There was a talk by a guy called Ian Johns, who's the chief IT architect at King's College London,
and
he gave this really interesting talk about how organisations that are swept up in sort of digital disruption, like Cliff was mentioning there, so how the online world has disrupted kind of traditional retailers and things like that, rather than being a retailer in that position and thinking, right, we'll fight back against those companies, you need to kind of embrace what's happening and innovate your way out of it, basically. So he used lots of examples in sort of over the course of his career. So one of the things was he previously worked at in newspaper publishing, just as sort of the bottom was falling out of that market. And so he had sort of first-hand example of kind of, okay, so our traditional advertising's getting out the window, you know, it's all moving online. How do we replace those revenues? So he worked for DMG Media, who own the Daily Mail. So he sort of gave the example of they started diversifying their business model in the face of this disruption, moved into events, moved into, I think, price comparison websites and stuff that he mentioned.
Yeah.
So it was all kind of stuff framed from his own experiences. And I won't give too much away because I wrote about it and you can read all about it on Computer Weekly. But that was a really interesting...
Read all about it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there you go. So that was a really interesting session. From the data center perspective, there was a few strands, conference sessions around sustainability, which is a topic we've talked about a little bit on the podcast a couple weeks ago. So the conversation from the show, though, was there is this thing at the moment that obviously a lot of the talk around data center sustainability does focus on how much power and energy that data centers consume. But there was this lady there called Deborah Andrews, who we've featured on Computer Weekly a couple of times, who works for London South Bank University, and she does loads of really interesting research into the circular economy and things like this. So she sort of put forward the view that rather than just focusing on power and energy, we need to be looking at the entire environmental impact that the data center sector has.
Mm-hmm.
So less about just focusing on power and more about, well, actually it's power in different ways. So she was saying we need to look at how much power goes into creating the hardware that sits inside data centers. We need to be looking at the kind of physical resources that building these huge shells and buildings and stuff takes up as well. There's liquid cooling in data centers isn't anything new, but there is more focus on it at the minute as because of kind of high compute workloads in data centers around sort of AI and things like that.
Yeah.
So to keep the servers cool, liquid cooling's having a bit of a resurgence at the minute, and obviously liquid cooling means that you're pumping a lot more water into data centers and things like that, so you're using people more resources.
Hmm.
So her kind of case was what we need to be looking at the total environmental impact that a data center has on the environment rather than just zeroing in on how much power and stuff they consume. So that's quite interesting.
I mean, it's interesting actually that you mentioned about you know, these big workloads, because one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, you've got these processors that are running at full whack.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe they're running a full web because people are writing inefficient code.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is anyone looking at that at the moment?
Oh, I haven't actually. I haven't heard that, actually. It seems to be...
It's Cliff's theory.
Yeah. But no, I haven't heard that, actually, as it happens.
But, I mean, if you're going to say make the best use of, you know, these advanced processors, the GPUs or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like how many clock cycles, how much time does it take to run the instructions, and the faster they go, obviously they get hotter, but you're also saying, well, I've got to write this tiny little bit of code to make it go as efficiently and as fast as possible, and, you know, do the job it has to do in the least amount of time, and that does have an impact on, obviously, the heat that is generated from the chips.
Mm.
I remember you writing about green IT quite extensively about 10 years ago, Cliff.
Passion project, was it?
I remember my first home computer, and I'm sure you guys did as well, where you had like 32 kilobytes of memory, and the amazing computer games that you could play on such a tiny amount of space.
Mm.
And today we have vast amount, almost infinite amount of storage, infinite amount of processing power and memory, and yet we were still sort of thinking, why can't we go back to the old days?
The good old days.
But of course, if there's a no-deal Brexit, then our problems, in a sense, will be solved because the data center industry is going to run out of power.
Yeah, it's going to go dark. Just all close down. Digital economy kaput. Well, no, that's not going to happen. But it is a school of thought. It is something. It's a conversation that we've been having. I guess quite a lot of PR messaging put our way from representatives from the data center industry who have kind of queried, and rightly so, that in the event of a no-deal Brexit, what will happen to, I guess, the security of our electricity supply in the UK, because we import so much power at the moment from Europe.
Yeah.
So the school of thought is, okay, so if there's a no-deal Brexit and we don't have any contingency plans, are we going to have a massive sudden deficit whenever Brexit does happen, which we don't know at the moment if and when that will be. So yeah, so there's been lots of speculation about it. It's also, some of the conversations on this have been exacerbated by things like, we've had stories, which I can't remember who wrote about it, but off the top of my head, it was on Computer Weekly a little while ago, about how in Amsterdam there's been kind of power supply issues over there, but it's more of a distribution issue, getting the power to the right place where the data centers are, and that is maybe cause some constraints around how quickly that market can grow, how much space they can bring on and stuff like that. So when you see examples like that, so okay, that's the problem. If there's not sufficient power in a market, that's the impact it can have. I think over in the UK at the moment, London specifically, the co-location market's booming. So anything on the horizon that makes you think, oh, okay, could that cause problems for us? It sharpens the mind, people speak out, they want to know, that kind of thing.
It does concentrate the mind, doesn't it, the whole context of Brexit. I mean, we're at the end of a week where there's been amazing shenanigans.
Yeah.
Verging on pandemonium in the House of Commons and so on. And I was observing that from Vienna, out of the country, where I was at the Open Texts customer and partner conference, Enterprise World Europe. Open Texts is always quite interesting for us because it's a piece of enterprise software that we actually use.
Mm.
Since they provide our beloved content management system, do Open Text. Open Text do a lot of other stuff as well, though. Canadian company, in the region of $3 billion turnover now, so they're not a small company by any means. They have deep expertise in content management, or enterprise information management, which is the category that they inhabit. But one of the briefings that I took at the conference was from a guy called Tom Leeson. Tom is their industry marketing strategist. It's a global role that he has for manufacturing and supply chain. It's a fellow Scot, so it's always quite nice to interview someone who has roughly the same accent as you. And what's quite cool, he's a kind of veteran, I think it would be fair to say, I'm sure he wouldn't object to me saying that, But he's worked in industry. It's always quite interesting when you meet someone at, say, a software company who isn't just someone who's always worked at a software company. You know, he's worked in aerospace and the automotive industry and so on. So he brings that to bear. But what he was specifically briefing me about, talking to me about, was some Brexit impact research. The impact of a number of Brexit scenarios on potentially anyway on the car industry. It was quite funny the way he described it. He said that one of the automakers, car makers that they deal with, came to them and said, "Have you got anything for Brexit?" As if it were like lumbago or something. As if they were looking for a tonic. And apropos of this, he got in touch with some academics at the Birmingham City University's Centre for Brexit Studies.
Wow.
There is such a thing. The lead academic there, I think there's quite a few of them, is Alex de Reuter. And they produced this report, which, I mean, quite often when you see a report that's sponsored by a supplier, it's usually some self-serving, quite kind of superficial and so on. And sure enough, the report does say if car companies can improve their enterprise information management portfolio, then they can deal more efficiently with the supply chain, and they can digitize more effectively and so on. So, you know, there is a message there. But it was quite interesting to talk to them. They've gone through, the academics went through all the different scenarios: Norway, backstop, CETA, the kind of Canada, Canada Plus type scenario, Turkey, and also no deal. But basically, the overall message was, whatever happens, then the application of enterprise information management will help to digitize things and make car companies more efficient. But one of the interesting things that he said was that Brexit provides a compelling reason to change. That generally in manufacturing, that there is a kind of wait and see approach.
Okay.
So they won't necessarily do the sort of things that we might assume that they should be doing unless there's a compelling reason to do so. And now they do. So they are looking at things like that. Apropos of this, it's a bit of an aside, but he told me of one of the car companies that they have drones on the manufacturing, on the floor, going up and down and taking video so they can do maintenance better.
Oh, okay.
But of course all that video has to be stored and interrogated somehow, which is where OpenText would come in. He also said something that I didn't quite appreciate, that the more you go down the tier in the industry, like the companies that make the gearboxes or make the seat covers or whatever, they have very, very little room for manoeuvre. So if the worst does happen, they're more or less finished.
They often provide just for one manufacturer, one specific part.
Yeah, and it's a big industry for us, 16.5 billion. And of course, the UK car industry has very much been revived by foreign direct investment. Honda, Nissan, BMW at Oxford and so on. And he basically did say that probably the car industry is the one that could well be most impacted by Brexit.
Yeah.
Even more so than others, because not only do you have the confusion of Brexit, which you can mitigate with with things like advanced shipping notices, you know, doing all that kind of documentation digitally, so you're kind of dissolving borders in a sense. Okay, fair enough. But with the car industry, you've also got all this autonomous cars stuff. There's a whole kind of wind of technology change that's going through the traditional car industry. The threat from Uber, you know, will people have cars in the future to the same extent? Probably not. Electric vehicles, Tesla, and so on and so forth. But another thing that he said, which I thought was quite interesting, this is not really to do with the research or their messaging, is that because we always think just-in-time production or just-in-sequence, but actually already, because of Brexit, some of the car makers have been abandoning those principles. they have been stocking parts that they might need just in case.
That makes sense.
So they're reintroducing
just in case
inefficiencies. So yeah, no, it was a good briefing. I thought I quite enjoyed that, because quite often these vendor sponsored bits of research are kind of superficial and self serving. But I don't think that would be fair to say that was true. That was true of this. So that was my time in Vienna. I also got to see, they took us to the Hofburg Palace.
Never been.
Amazing. the centre of power of the Habsburg Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
We were serenaded by the Vienna Boys Choir.
Very nice. What, privately?
Conference.
Okay.
Which was pretty amazing. And these are the benefits, some of the side benefits that we get from our jobs, I guess.
Yeah, I've been to Vienna once on a press trip, but it's...
Did you see any of Vienna?
No, it's another one of these places that someone will say to me, like, oh, have you ever been? And I'll be, oh, I've never been. Like, oh, I have. But it was like one night, I was in the hotel, I went straight to the conference center, and then I went straight to the airport. So that, Vienna, Milan, I think Paris as well, of all places that I've just been for one night only. That's
these beautiful European cities. And of course, Cliff spends a lot of time in Barcelona.
Ah, Barcelona. Always, every opportunity.
Well, I was in Vienna where Freud invented psychoanalysis. This is a very contrived link coming up. There's a famous case of the Wolfman and Freud psychoanalysis. Now, Cliff is going to talk to us about the Furman.
Very good. That's a one show kind of link there. Very
so
good.
What is the Furman Review?
It is, to give it its full title, Unlocking Digital Competition. So it's a report that was prepared for Philip Hammond, Chancellor of the Exchequer, and it's a 6-month review looking into the UK's digital economy. What did it find? Well, it's basically saying there are a couple of really big web companies out there. You know the ones, we've mentioned them already. There's Google, there's Twitter, there's Facebook, and they do two things. They acquire customers very easily with almost no competition. That the Competitions Authority don't really look into these big acquisitions that are being made, and you suddenly get another billion customers or whatever. That's an exaggeration, but you get millions and millions of more customers by these acquisitions. They are in a position where they effectively take over startups. In fact, I didn't even know this. There was one that I was... one of my favourite services is Shazam, which... I interviewed the CIO of Shazam a few years ago. It's such a clever service. And I didn't know this, but it's now owned by Apple.
Oh, really?
It was owned by Apple. And I was looking in the papers a few days ago. Spotify is having some problems because on the App Store they charge a premium because it's a music service. So you pay a lot more for downloading the app than you would if, you know, Spotify was just, you know, well, on Google it's a lower price. And there is a sense that the web giants have an unfair advantage. They gather lots and lots of information. So this is the other part of it. They gather lots and lots of information about lots and lots of people. Now, if we honestly believe that the future is in data, in understanding people better than we understand ourselves...
Yes, that's a theme that we've discussed on this podcast, Joe.
The likes of Facebook and Google and Twitter are in a really strong position. And one question is, how does a small company in the UK get... prominence, you know, how does it establish itself? I mean, you've only got to look at, you know, DeepMinds, you know, an amazing technology firm that's now DeepMinds part of Google.
Yeah, it's Google DeepMind, yeah.
I mean, that's a good thing, but, you know, it just shows how, you know, even the very, very smartest tech, you know, we in the UK, you know, we somehow can't keep that. If it's really good, it gets, and Shazam similarly was a UK company, it gets acquired by these, you know, huge US organisations.
So what does the Furman Review recommend then?
Well, I mean, it's basically saying that the companies need a code of conduct. What does that mean? Well, you know...
What, the big Silicon Valley companies?
Big Silicon Valley companies. I did actually get an email from one of these organisations that's basically representing the US IT industry and saying, well, it's all wrong. You know, we collect data for a reason. Of course you do. And it fits in very well with what Tim Berners-Lee and the Web Foundation are saying, that the web can't go on this way. Commercial businesses, startups, our established high street, we've talked about that. I mean, all of these organisations are really at a huge disadvantage compared to the massive web companies, and they tend to be massive US web companies. Of course, there's Alibaba. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're talking about the West, but obviously
Yeah.
In China. And that's in a similar position, very, very strong, you know, dominant position. And not only that, just look at it, they can get around our tax laws. Should we say that on the record? They can, can't they? Some of these companies can. Some of these companies can use the gig economy in a way that means that they don't have to pay for full-time staff.
Yeah.
And, you know, taxable, things like that. But unlike the businesses that, you know, started prior to the web, where, you know, there was much more control, much more compliance. I mean, I'm sure that when, you know, if you ended up talking about one day in the future about how someone like Amazon becomes a financial services organization, what happens to banking? You know, what happens to the high street? There's small startups that are doing banking, you know, there's a huge number of them. But what happens when one of the dominant players on the web becomes an online bank?
And maybe uses blockchain to affect that. This thing that Tim Berners-Lee invented seems to have spiraled a bit out of his control.
On that point, though, because there's been other reports recently suggesting some of the investigation into Facebook said, we need a code of conduct to bring Facebook under control. We need a central body to regulate Facebook. You have to ask the question, like, is it the horse has bolted now? Is that how... can we bring these things back under control? Or, you know, what needs to happen? Is a code of conduct going to be enough?
Well, it was interesting. A few weeks ago, the Irish Data Commissioner, that's like our information commissioner, was looking at GDPR infringements. And a couple of the things came up. Facebook was mentioned about 10 times or 7 times in this document that they produced an annual report. But what I found interesting was that they're looking at things like how an organization uses APIs and data and advanced data analytics in ways that, you know, this is not GDPR. It doesn't say GDPR. You can't use advanced analytics. And, you know, that's just as well, you know, maybe the regulators are looking at this. They're looking at it from a data protection, data privacy point of view.
Well, we're not going to solve all these problems in the course of this podcast, but we'll come back to all these matters we've been discussing, the Facebook coverage that Computer Weekly has been doing recently on this podcast. But I think that's all we have time for today. It just remains for me to thank Caroline, thank you very much, and Cliff, our special guest today.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks to you for listening. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye.